Welcome to Art with
Fiona Verity.
Say it again.
Fiona?
No.
Fiona Verity.
And Julie Nicholson.
Okay.
Yes.
We're off.
And we're off.
Okay. Giles Alexander,
hi.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome.
We're in your very amazing studio in St. Peter's. We've been to St. Peter's before, but we got a bit lost, actually.
Hence my kind of elongated
thank you for that.
Directions, because people
good.
Do get lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we recognise places when we go to people's studios. We're like, I think Black Douglas is near here whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we haven't been to this part.
We are country bumpkins, that's right, isn't it? We come to the city and we're...
Yes, we do. We get very excited. And you've got the most amazing car in your studio that you restored, and a train set and guitars. It's like a playground.
And it's a playground.
A proper coffee machine.
Proper cop, mate. We're impressed.
Plants.
You've got to do these things.
Yeah.
If you're going to do them, you've got to do it properly.
Yeah, it's like your second home, right?
It is, absolutely. Yeah.
How long do you spend in the studio, do you think?
Look, I am fairly workaday these days with a, you know, with a young family as we, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about this often. It used to be, you know, all day, every day. And actually, you have a child and then you wrestle with that, like redefining your relationship with the studio for a bit.
Yeah.
But now it is so much more efficient. And I don't know whether efficiencies are really what I'm aspiring to as an artist. You know, I don't actually want to be efficient. No, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not something, you know.
You don't want your show to be called efficient.
No, not ideally. I mean,
9 to 5.
I think efficiency is underrated, Giles, because as a parent, I think that's one thing you get really good at.
That's right.
Because
yeah.
your time's precious.
You cut the crap.
Exactly.
Know? Get straight to the point.
I think it's very effective. I think it's...
And
it's,
and that's refreshing to hear from a man and
yes.
take that in the right way, that you're bothered, because a lot of men would go, not
yeah,
my problem.
Look, I love what I do in this room, in this studio, and I'm so, you know... Dare I say, proud of what I've achieved over the last 15 years. In fact, you know, I was just rejigging my website recently. It needed a bit of work, as they do every kind of 18 months, 2 years, and went through, got fine-tooth comb. And looking back, I can really, honestly, hand on my heart, look back and go, you know, I've made some reasonable work and I feel good about what I have produced over the last 15 plus years. But that all said, what happens outside of here...
Ooh.
With my family that's
important.
Real life. And that's it.
Yeah.
So, and of course that all feeds into what happens in here, of course, like, you know, but yeah.
Both
keep a bit of perspective and balance on these things.
Bloody loop.
You know?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I like that philosophy.
I do,
Giles.
Anyway. I mean, people are different, and some people are mad, crazed, obsessive, and they create incredible work, and some people are mad, crazed, and obsessive and create shit work. So, you know, you just got to...
But I like the fact that you've sort of equated your success that, you know, you are proud of what you've achieved and you can look back and actually go, you know, I genuinely believe I've done some good work whilst maintaining
a family life
that...
Yeah, because you don't have to, because it is a bit of an old...
I don't know if achieving so much in your artwork and then leaving the rest of your life behind is success.
No, but look, people are different.
They are different.
It works differently for different people. That's what works for me.
That's true.
But there is this old hangover of in the past that in order to be successful,
yes.
that you have to almost be an asshole of a parent, and you can't be a real artist. And
I guess the crux of that sentence is the word success, and people's ideas about success are wholly different. And that's what was really interesting, I thought, with your discussion with Nick.
Mm.
You know, and I think most artists will give you... Most artists will give you a different version of that definition.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm still waiting on my my retrospective at MoMA. So if that's the measure of success, I haven't got there yet. But then, you know, success, I think, has to... I mean, it's such a personal journey. It's such a wholly kind of, personal thing. You're locked away in this studio, you know, for the majority of the day, and the buck stops here. And so the success, you know, has to be with me. Like if I feel that works are successful, then that's success.
Yes.
The other stuff is, yeah, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
Yeah.
So do you mean individually? Because this is one of the questions I've had, was what are you chasing? What is your definition of success? Because it's so individual. But do you mean with an individual painting, or do you mean with a body of work?
I think
or?
With both. I mean, my practice tends to meander a bit. I think like there's a central core theme which has stayed pretty constant throughout my 15 odd years of professional and inverted commas like practicing. Obviously, there's 25 plus years to back that up, as a kid and as a human growing, which I hopefully am still doing. Each work I like to kind of play and push my practice. There's a lot of things that interest me, and I don't want to just kind of sit still and just go, this is what I do, and kind of
Do you feel like you're moving your goalposts though? Like a lot of people perhaps being hung in the Archibald is a benchmark, or being taken on by one of the top galleries in the city. Do you feel that every time you get to a point you're like,
well, they're external benchmarks, aren't they?
Okay,
external, and then you've got your external life and your internal life.
Ooh.
And I think your internal life is way more interesting and way more kind of important, really. I mean, like external benchmarks and, that's how the outside world measures, holds a yardstick up against you. Yeah. And that's, obviously that is not without merit. That's not without...
No. They're valid.
Yeah, they are, but... ultimately, at the end of the day, the person, you lie your head on the bed and go to sleep, and you're the only person you're left with. Know?
Well, so, I think doing the podcast, we've worked out that there is no steps to the art world. There's no ladder. No. There's no steps. Like you are your art and what you do with it, and then, like you say, those external things is what you could class as the art world.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you have to be. Yeah. On your own journey, whatever you call it yourself.
Which we all are, of course, like every human is. I mean, I think that the only difference with like a creative outlet is that in some way you get to express that. So you're extraordinarily privileged. I mean, not in the kind of, I mean, like you got to fight for it as well. I'm not saying it's like, easy, but you are privileged in so much as you fight for the ability to express the world that you find around you. And that's, everyone's experiencing the world around them, everyone.
Yeah. But I think some people, whether you class them as artists or not, are the ones that are really curious always, constantly. And whether that's a scientist or a musician or whatever, you're constantly curious. Whereas I think some people just sort of stop at some point and just don't seem to question a lot. And I think that's what defines someone who's artistic or whatever. They're really uncovering the stones, which you are, Giles. So we saw your work, your last exhibition at Olsen Gallery.
Beautiful.
And so the paintings, planets, they're fiery, they're dynamic, they're otherworldly. And your work is about a sense of belonging. And I think it sounds like it's always been that kind of a theme.
Yeah.
Like, what interests you about that?
Well, the three of us here are displaced. Fortunately for us...
That's my second question, mate.
Yeah, well, fortunately for us, we have self-determination. Presumably, you weren't running, fleeing from war zone or, political persecution. So we're at a massive advantage, but we chose to come and live here on the opposite side of the earth. But nevertheless, we are on the opposite side of the earth from our origins, right? And so there's... For me, anyway, I won't speak for you, but I presume there's something of this going on for anyone who has, placed themselves in another culture, in another nation. For me, there's this little internal kind of conversation, like the reconciling between your current, newfound and much loved and adored, habitat and environment that I live in and where I'm from. And it's a weird one, Australia, because there's so many cultural similarities and reference points. But I reckon that's actually slightly disconcerting, actually, I think, because almost it actually makes you more acutely aware that it's not.
I totally agree.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very strange thing.
Because I'm from the Cotswolds, yeah. When I go to Kangaroo Valley, yeah. I go, oh my goodness, how this is just like home. Mm, and then yeah. I see a palm tree and yeah, I go, it's yeah. like the Twilight
yeah.
Zone.
Yeah.
I go, do. Yeah. I'm not at home. Yeah. I find that really... Yeah. I found that quite weird.
It is disconcerting because it's kind of there's this veneer of home, inverted commas. I mean, this is home in no uncertain terms. I've got no aspirations to go and live back in the UK. I live here. I love living here. My family's here. I love it. But if you take the term home as in where you're from, your origin, yeah, there's this thin veneer of England, of the UK, but. That's on top of just this, you know, towering, fucking colossal, beautiful natural environment, which is completely unlike home.
Mm.
Yeah.
Apart from, of course, New South Wales, which has a striking resemblance to South Wales in England, as we all know.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I find that acute, like that sense of, you know, and I suppose, you know, we're not immigrants in that sense because we chose to come here, or a lot of immigrants, but, you know, we... You know, as English coming here as well, and everyone's like, oh, it's just like home. And I'm like, oh, God, it really isn't. And you have to, I think it's been 20 years journey of trying to place how I belong here.
Well, there you go. That's my artwork.
Yeah.
That's my paintings. That's what motivates me. It's,
finding your place.
It is, yeah. I mean, I did go to boarding school, so that probably plays out in there as well, because so I think that was set up from an early age, even though, look, I had a great experience at boarding school, wouldn't have changed it for a moment.
Were you 11? Did you go 11 or
12?
12,
yeah. But obviously that's a thing, and, you know, I think that enabled me just at a very early age not to even question the idea of living elsewhere. You know, I didn't even question it.
No.
Really, probably very in a cavalier kind of way, as you do when you're a kid. You don't think of long-term kind of, you know, consequences. The most bitter or the hardest long-term consequence is really the distance between, you know, my parents. And so that's the biggest thing that I've, you know, had to, as I'm sure, you know, I'm not alone with. Really, my art practice seeks to, and has, since I can kind of really remember, has sought to, like, navigate those questions. And again, I'm not alone. I mean, it's a very, these days, it's a very familiar
quest.
And I always thank, you know, I'm just very thankful that I did, and I do have self-determination over, you know, my kind of self-imposed displacement, but many don't.
That's very true.
Don't you find it really weird, though, like people's childhoods, you don't even know it, but like, I don't know whether it's this sort of like a turtle knows where to come back to lay its eggs. Like, there's something so heavy about where you grew up.
Mm.
And I know people that maybe moved around a lot don't have that kind of thing. But
I'm looking at you both going, what?
Oh, I have such a sense of
wherever you lay your hat.
Yeah, you have a different... Yeah. I mean, it's not.
Oh no, I do. I have a very
No. You still have. It's the same emotional baggage.
Of course, it is. It's just very different.
Causality is slightly different, and it would, you know, manifest now in a slightly different way.
I find it really difficult to put down roots.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because for me, every 2 years you move, I get bored really quickly.
Okay.
So it is. Yeah. It's all in your DNA in a way, or the way your, you know, nature nurture argument.
That's it. Yeah.
But so when you went to boarding school, was that when you won the scholarship?
Yeah.
So what was that?
Oh, well, I mean, my mum, you know, eternally grateful for... She just saw this advert in the newspaper, as you did.
That's
back then.
So cool.
And put me... I think loads of kids just spend, you know, certainly back then, pre-internet and pre-computers.
Yeah.
I spent essentially my childhood just drawing. I mean, my father's an architect... He painted, so it was something that just was always there,
familiar.
Accessible, familiar, and that's just what I did. So I spent my whole childhood doing that, and then I guess at some point, my mum, look, saw this advert, thought it was a great opportunity, it was a great school.
But and good on your mum. Yeah, I love that.
So you got a scholarship for the school with art.
Yeah, yeah, it was an art scholarship, yeah.
Do you remember what you showed them?
I probably would have showed them lots of racing cars.
Yes.
Rum, rum. Yeah, I would have. And actually, racing cars I was doing. So my dad was an architect, and you do these things. You know, I see it with my son, you know. You learn by mimicking. I mean, that's what you know, totally. Mimicking, and that's what model making is. You know, models in the kind of physical sense, but also you build models in your mind, and that process teaches you about the world. So I used to set myself up on my little drawing board, which I think I got for, you know, an 11th birthday or something, and I had tracing paper as all good architects use.
Yeah.
And I had my rotoring repeater graphs.
Oh my God, I love those.
I'd love them too. I've used them again in my work. I love those things. And I used to do like working drawings, like plan elevation of like cameras and like, you know, fighter jets and yeah, all this. Yeah.
Did you have some nice rulers?
Rulers and set squares and...
So yep. Good.
Do you think that's why you went into...
It's quite a fetish, you know, like, you know, yes. You know, drawing and art materials are quite a fetish.
They are. They really are.
You have to calm yourself. But do you think that's why your work is quite, you know, technical, old
almost
mastery,
certainly.
That kind of...
Yeah, I think so. It was, I guess, the two things, you know, my dad certainly is very, a lot about precision and things are measured and, you know, I was kind of weaned on, you know, perspective, the idea of perspective. I could kind of do perspective before I could, you know, probably read properly.
Mm.
And then that coupled with, yeah, living on the outskirts of London and regularly going to, you know, National Gallery, the, you know, Tate Britain. And then when we went overseas, going to galleries there. So, yeah, really having that kind of early engagement with in great, you know.
Yeah.
Were you like drawn to those kind of Canaletto's, the
perspective? Yeah, I mean, I've just had the most indulgent bloody 3-week trip back. I've just seen my mum for the first time in 3 years. I surprised her. It was awesome.
Oh,
she
gorgeous.
Was actually speechless, which if anyone knows my mum, it's like...
It's a miracle.
Yeah, yeah, a total miracle. She was like... She couldn't speak. It was amazing.
So cute.
But I did...
You be careful. You might give her a heart attack.
I know. Well, I was kind of a little
I did the same
bit,
thing,
yeah.
And
she wasn't
I was
speechless.
Very concerned
yeah,
about heart
yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I know. I was kind of aware
They've got
of
defibrillators
so.
In all the villages yeah. now. It's fine.
That's it. Yeah. But it was just a complete... Yeah.
What did you do?
Oh, I just... I mean, I had some meetings with galleries along the way, but I was just catching up with old friends, but particularly, yeah, old friends in you know, big
beautiful
galleries.
Places.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, but just in old collections, you know, just yeah, familiarizing, kind of topping up on all the good old stuff, which I miss dearly.
Yeah,
I know. I like that kind of painting as well. That traditional. I did an art history A level, and we did a lot of, you know, Hans Holbein all that stuff.
I mean,
it's just so good, and the history behind it. It sort of interweaves so many different, you know, subjects and themes.
That's
it's
it.
So interesting.
I mean, well, painting is painting as, you know, a very, very long, you know, very long story. And we, you know, contemporary art and the you know, the art practices of, you know, people of, you know, the last 20, 30 years or whatever and stretching forward, they're the tiny little tip of the iceberg of... centuries, millennia of artistic, you know, practice and
people being influenced by each other.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So you've done a lot of study, haven't you?
Done a bit of study, yeah.
A bit?
A little.
Just
there's
a few.
A lot of study.
There's a lot.
You've done multimedia, graphic design, 3D, MFA.
Are you reading
the
BFC?
This is all on your CV.
There's a lot of
this
study.
It's all
a bit of
filler.
Study.
So when you came from the UK to Australia...
Yeah.
Then you enrolled in the National Art School?
I did. So what actually happened, I got a studio really quickly with the delightful Libby Knott. Do you know Libby Knott? She now runs Art Money. But
We did meet her.
She's gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she has been responsible for a good number of really amazing artists. Like, you know, I say responsible. I mean, she ran a gallery studio just on Coomer Street, just in Paddington, for the early noughties when I showed up.
Were you a practicing artist when you showed up?
Yeah,
though?
So when I was struggling to kind of, so the last few years in London, I was doing murals and commissions and stuff for people, partying a lot and, you know, having a great time, as you should be doing in your early 20s London. Yeah. So
if you remember it, you didn't party hard enough.
And then I did find myself here by way of like a good year or so travelling in Southeast Asia. And then the second week I was here, I met my now wife. So, and then I think that same week I met Libby, and she offered me a studio at this gallery. And then I met, you know, dear old, I mean, you know, at the same time, you know, I met Nicholas Harding, who very sadly we lost, you know, last week. Yeah. But also, you know, Martine Mdur was studying, painting those studios. Rob Malherbe, Tim Summerton.
Wow. I just said his name. Yes. You never know how to say his name.
Malherbe. I would say Malherbe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's
I think you've got it right.
I probably mispronounced it. He's probably going, Charles, you idiot.
But did they encourage you to sign up for NAS or?
So Libby did. So Anna, my wife's an academic, so she was doing a PhD then. And she lectures in sustainability in photovoltaics, so solar energy.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, she's an electrical engineer.
Awesome.
And she was writing a PhD in Nicaragua, so we went and lived in Central America for a year.
Nice.
And then when I came back, Libby, you know, I was kind of, next step. And Libby said, go down to National Art School. And then like a week later, I was enrolled.
To do your BFA?
Yes, that's
it. So you went back to the beginning.
Well, I did. They gave me a year advanced standing, so I actually started in the second year. I did my BFA, then my honours, then my master's there.
And what were you painting when you started that?
Cars. No, I'm joking. There's a theme here. No, I wasn't. I don't know. I was painting volcanoes. Yeah.
Because of Nicaragua.
Because I love volcanoes. What's not so... Yeah, and because I've just been to Nicaragua. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Awesome.
That's exciting. So they gave you the first... So you didn't have to do first year?
No.
And then you just went straight into painting?
Yeah.
And then you did MFA?
But so did you have to fight about painting realistically?
No, not really. I mean, not... look, I probably did... But
no bad thing.
Interestingly, no, that's exactly right. It's no bad thing at all. You've got to, you know, all of those battles, they're constant. And all they really are is you butting up against the world and saying, this is what I do. This is, I mean, and so the short answer to that is no. The problem with art, the problem with teaching art nowadays is it's such a diverse field. And, you know, unfortunately, because I then subsequently taught at NAS for a couple of years.
Yeah, I saw that.
And, I can understand why, but a lot of students come away quite frustrated because they don't get what they enrolled for. But what they enrolled for is a really, you know, it's very hard to, because the field is so diverse. I mean, someone might enroll wanting to paint like Jackson Pollock. Another person might enroll wanting to paint like Dirk Belts or, you know, Roger van der Weyden. Mm. How do you teach both of those people in a class of 20? I mean, it's just, you can't
impossible.
Do it. And the resources are limited. The time is limited. So you have to, you end up, I think... To stand any kind of chance whatsoever, you have to just stick to your guns.
You have to have an intention.
This is what I want
to
do.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't battling against, I want to be a realist painter.
And do you think you're better off perhaps than not being 19 or 18?
Yeah, so look, mature students so help that.
Look, I picked up that on a couple of your other podcasts. Yeah. I think the only point there to make is that, you know, the older you are, firstly, you got a bit more time to just work technically with what you know, what feels right to you. But secondly, you gotta have something to say, and you know,
exactly.
Having something to say you might have some that thing to say, but it's hard to kind of pull that thing out. Certainly in your late teens, arguably in your early 20s, and you know, they're reflective kind of. Anyway, yeah.
But you can have a very mature 19-year-old.
You absolutely can. Those rules are there to be broken. You know, absolutely. They're just sweeping statements.
I was just curious because I know that the painting department in all art schools now is perhaps more conceptual than it's ever been. Wondering whether as a hype, would you consider yourself a hyper-realist? Realist?
No.
Do you?
No. I hate those terms.
Yeah, I was really going to say. It's horrible pigeonholing anyway.
So I showed with a guy in the States called Lou Mizell, who coined the phrase photorealism.
Yes, and I saw that on your website. Yeah, you got that great.
I mean, it was, what an honour.
1969, did he coin that?
1969. And he started working with and gave a voice to all these guys who were coming through who were working in that way that had not been a thing at all before that. But it was always it was a great honour and it was a great rush and buzz to be showing in his gallery, you know, in Soho, New York.
Yeah.
Awesome. But I didn't feel, it wasn't right and I didn't fit in there because, you know, there's a lot about my practice that is
not
what it's about. I mean, it's an element, but it's not what my practice is about.
No.
So, I don't know. It's a tricky, all those terms, you know, they're tricky.
Well, it says somewhere that your work is postmodern.
Does it?
Yeah. But I don't actually know what that means.
No, we wanted
I don't know. I thought I was hoping you'd tell me.
Because I'm like, okay,
I didn't write that.
Postmodern.
Yeah.
I think that's...
all that means is after modernity, after modernism. Yeah. Modernism
is
ended...
Now.
No, modernism. Modernism in art terms ended like 50 plus years ago. I mean...
When the market began.
Yeah, really. And then that's the start of the contemporary art market. But who knows where we are now? I think we've run out of terms.
I think so.
Well, that's right. I mean we try not to, like, on the podcast, I just like calling people artists. Otherwise, God, it means you can, only sculpt and only
do this. Especially because we have these great conversations with people who are painters and there's no paint and there's...
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
We met that amazing artist who I think I called her a textile artist and she's like, I'm a painter.
Yeah.
But
she
uses thread.
Yes. Yeah.
So
it's best.
We're all artists.
Yeah.
Let's keep it broad.
But your work has spent a lot of time looking at planets and space.
Mm.
But you're using like that sort of fantastic amount of detail, small brushes, so that you know, that they're technically really tight, but the subject matter is really expansive.
Yeah.
Like, why, I know it's about belonging, but why particularly planets and space?
Well, I guess I see that my little theory, and it is only that.
Come on, Charles.
Yeah, and I'll spit it out.
Come on.
Is that, I guess, you know, cutting edge science, you know, micro and macro, whether it's about, you know, the Big Bang or quantum theory, is really, you know, society's equivalent to religions. The function of religions historically was, I mean, you know, saying a security blanket is maybe a little bit harsh and mean, but it was a way for humans to, in some way, you know, answer those questions about where do we come from? What are
why
we doing
are we
here? Why are we here? Why is the, you know, why is there thunder and lightning? Why are there volcanoes? Why are there earthquakes? Why are there storms? Well, all of these natural phenomena, which, you know, progressively we have found a way to empirically explain away. And we're, you know, that the beauty of, you know, empirical kind of knowledge rather than dogmatic religion is that it's ever reassessing itself. It's never cast in stone. It's always open to the possibility that it's wrong. That's the scientific.
This is what we know now.
But it can be proven incorrectly tomorrow. But not proven in a hard sense. Not this is the final answer. Just it's always always kind of tinkering and refining the theory, right?
Yeah.
But you move progressively toward a greater place of understanding. And so I guess I'm using, imagery, very kind of cutting edge imagery of the cosmos, really because I am fascinated with, and I've always been really drawn to, you know, art history and the lessons of art history and, you know, painting in particular. And, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but I'll go with 90% of, you know, art history pre, you know, 100 years ago was all religious in you know, I mean, art overwhelmingly religious, because those paintings were there to tell stories to, I mean, you know, you look at cathedrals, you know, the cycles, you know, for example, round chapels, let's say, like the Arena Chapel in Padua, Giotto, you know, who signifies, you know, the start of the Renaissance. Though that's from a direct lineage of really, you know, those paintings are there just as, not propaganda, but a way to tell a story to an illiterate mass. You know, the masses were couldn't read.
Yeah.
And they'd go to a big fancy building.
Stained glass.
Correct. So, yeah, that's it. So
control.
There's all sorts of kind of negative connotations. There's all sorts of positive connotations. I mean,
Feeling like you belong.
You're correct.
We're back to that.
Yes, there you go. Yeah. Exactly.
It's being part of a group and a community.
Yeah, and a communion. And you know, and arguably, you know, I think that's, for example, what's attractive about, you know, the art world for many people. It provides community, and that community that really doesn't exist in 21st century capitalist society, because we've all been convinced to become relentless individuals, you know, all about me, everyone else, you know, and so we're also bereft of freaking community.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I do like churches and stuff. I'm not religious, but I find them fascinating and oddly comforting places, because they kind of demand something of you. They just demand.
I find them really frightening.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that the fact that they evoke emotion is so powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm frightened of the fact that I don't believe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I have family that do believe.
Yes.
So I think I've been told so many times I'm going to burn in hell.
Why is space then for you this connotation of religion?
Because I think it's it's, for me, I think it's the closest kind of contemporary metaphor for grappling with who I am, where I am, where I've come from, and back to kind of belonging.
The fact that we know so little really about
the
universe,
or the more you don't know.
And I think coming to Australia made me really conscious of how small I am. You know, you go to these vast places, you go to the centre of Australia, into the desert, and or you drive across the hay plains, and you're like, Jesus Christ, it's so flat.
Funny, I thought I was a universe.
And on and on. No,
something's
wrong. I feel like a dot.
Yeah.
You know, whereas in Britain, I felt very much like I felt big in a small place.
And then you start thinking about the expanses of space.
Yeah. You know, I can't get my head around it.
No,
at
no
all.
One can. If you think you can, you really can't.
And then you start listening to Brian Cox, and then he completely screws you.
William Shatner.
Brilliant. I mean, but to me, there is absolutely no need for a religious text whatsoever. Like actual empirical science is so much more fantastical. I mean, really, what could be more incredible than, you know, once we die, we return to the earth, and slowly after billions of years, ultimately, when the sun kind of, you know, consumes earth and, you know, explodes, and we're jettisoned back off into space, you know, and we might, you know, eventually collapse down into another star, a billion. I mean, like, it's too fantastical to, I mean, you couldn't write it, and no one did. That's the thing. The stories in religious texts are so, you know, mundane. They're so really? And they're so obviously written by men.
Yes.
You know?
Well, that's why it's called his story.
Correct. And God always looks oddly like it, you know, his, whoever wrote the book, you know?
It's just,
yeah. No. Funny that. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting on.
Yes, we're getting off track. So let's go back to technique, because you do have a lot of technique, Giles. Where have you learnt to paint quite so amazingly?
And you're so tidy. I love it. Look at it.
Yeah.
That is totally just a character flaw. You know, the tidiness is just, I mean, I don't know. You, I mean, my son's pretty tidy as well. My wife's tidy. I mean, we're just
You're tidy people.
We're tidy people.
That's nothing wrong with being tidy. I'm jealous. I am the messiest person on the planet.
I don't know, but you know, do you think that not consciously. Helps look, it helps my aesthetic of with course. What I do because, you know, I work with really absolute surfaces. I don't know why. It just appeals to me. I mean, anyway.
But you've really shifted from the oldest medium in the world of oil to acrylic.
Yeah.
And I can see you use beautiful golden colours and we will take a photo because I just love it. Giles has these mini pots and colour chart where he's mixed probably to, you know, the nth sort of microbe of technical ability. Could you paint any other way?
No, I mean, I paint the way I'm made. And I remember, you know, having those conversations with students at art school. I mean, you are
who you are.
Yeah, and I mean, I would love to slap paint around, you know, some days. I just think, I just can't do that. It's not in my makeup,
don't need
not
to.
Me.
No.
I don't know. I mean, they're just skills that, you know, you accrue over time. And they're all, you know, I think the golden word here is practice. You know, it is a practice. Mm. And practice infers there is no destination. You know, it's a journey. It's not, you know, I mean, so I'm torturously, you know, learning to play the guitar. And I it's been a kind of thing in the background for me for 20 plus years. But I'm doing it in a more earnest way, you know, in the last couple of years. But I'm rubbish. I mean, you know, but I love it. I love it.
It's good to be rubbish at
it
something.
It is.
Yes.
Well, I mean, we're rubbish in lots of things. But,
I don't reckon you are, though. No. I think you're one of those people, Giles. I'm probably being far too familiar. But I think you've probably always been very good at stuff.
Look, I'm
art scholarship at 12.
I recognise that I had strengths in, you know, 2D, you know, representational kind of art making.
Yeah.
And I also recognised some years later that I didn't have the same maybe natural affinities with music making, okay? And so I concentrated on the art and, you know, almost certainly rightly so. But that doesn't mean that now I don't love playing the guitar and I don't love wrestling with it. But it's all a journey. And, you know, any great guitarist you could shake a stick at. I mean, you know, one of my personal favourites and one of my gods is Django Reinhardt. I mean, incredible. But there's, you know, so many, Stevie Ray Vaughan, blah, blah, blah. If you ask any of them if they'd achieved what they've arrived or they've achieved, of course they haven't. None of them have. They're all practicing.
Every day to get better.
That's what they do.
It's also good, I think, when you are very good at one thing, you're very good at painting, to challenge yourself because you're using a completely different part of your brain to be at the beginning of something.
It has done so much for my practice. That's massively. Yeah. In the last couple of years, it has liberated me. I can't even really express how much it has shifted.
Shakes you up.
It's just shifted the way I approach painting.
That's great.
How amazing. Have you approached it differently, do you think?
Well, look, these blurry works I've kind of started making over the last couple of years, they're actually very performative.
Did you show these the annex?
Yeah, that's right. So the thinking with that was that, you know, there's always been a couple or so things going on in my practice and this was an opportunity just to kind of compartmentalise them. And I consider them and I approach them as flip sides of the same coin. So on the one side, you've got these very crystalline, you know, empirical, you know, quasi-scientific views of us, of our predicament, of how we see ourselves in the world. And then on the flip side, you've got these blurry, heady kind of, you know, transcriptions of, you know, art history. And art history, as we've just been discussing, in my view, you know, its major function was to explain what our predicament, what we're doing here, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So they were kind of, the two bodies of work were really talking about the same thing, but from starting at different ends of the spectrum.
Oh, I see. I get that. They're really beautiful.
They are. They really
because
are.
Because I said, I am blind as a bat, so it's the first time I've seen something that I could literally say someone. That is what I see when I take
making them is so interesting because as we were discussing before, I've become a spectacle wearer in the last couple of years, and that was an interesting, because I really had it in my mind that I had great vision. I was in denial for a while, started putting my spectacles on, and I was like, oh, shit, I think I've been using the force for like the last 2 years kind of painting.
I love it.
But now, making the blurry works, so a couple of things. Airbrush has become central to my practice. So, you know, I played with airbrush a load when I was a kid. And in fact,
Did you use
that because you were building models?
It was because I was model making.
But did you have the one that I used, the one that you used to physically blow?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I love that. I blocked that out.
Oh, my God.
The paint that I swallowed.
If you sucked, I was about to say, you get
My mum would be like, oh,
well, the weird thing is, so I just had this trip home back to the UK, and my mum surprised me with, you know, a bunch of, you know, old photographs, primary school photographs. And in there was also my prized possession, my airbrush techniques book. And I blocked it out of my... I'd completely forgotten this thing.
Because so it was quite new, wasn't it?
It was. And so I was explaining to Bruno, my son, the other day about airbrushing. And really, it's the proto kind of CGI thing because it was used in a lot of kind of advertising and illustration and games possibly in the same way that CGI, you know, way more effectively does nowadays. So it was very... good at kind of illustrating, and that's not a dirty word, illustrating the world, you know, in a very kind of, I guess, like a photographic way.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess that was what attracted me when I was a kind of 10, 11-year-old. So I did a lot of airbrush, but what I love about it now with these works is just, you know, just this kind of immaculate, completely non-linear soft edge.
Totally. It's not a line in there. Them not because, a hard edge.
No, that's right. They're the antithesis of the other work, which is what I love about it. It's just this kind of amorphous smoke haze, and trying to make sense out of that is a lot of fun.
And there's not even a drip.
You're very good at it.
Oh, you do.
He's a technical whiz.
He is. So
they're lush.
Hang on, I will think of it. The other thing we wanted to ask you on your paintings of space, because Fiona uses a black paint called Varta Black,
don't you?
Yeah. No, not Varta. Vanta. Not that, because...
Oh, you're not allowed to. That's not allowed to.
I bought Stuart Semple's.
Yes. Oh, you've got it too.
Love it.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I love the whole story. You're much better at it.
All I do is I spray it on. I use an automotive spray...
like a spray gun.
Essentially what I painted that car with.
You just put it with that paint in it.
And then you just get this beautiful.
Isn't it the best? I love that stuff.
And it's totally matte. Look, I was looking for, I used a resin on my work for many years, you know.
As a top coat?
As a spatial device. So, you know, my work I keep banding this quote around, and I come back to it a lot. The Mirandi quote that he says, there's nothing more abstract than a realist painting.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, in so much as trying to represent three dimensions on a two-dimensional surface is kind of folly, right?
It's
madness, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, correct. And you need, and we're back to, you know, I guess, like the difference perhaps between us and animals, you know, it's that it requires abstract thinking, okay, to make that intellectual leap. And in fact, you know, perspective is just a convention, you know. It's a convention that we, you know, developed in the 15th century. It's so much so that you couldn't even extrapolate perspective out of contemporary society. We just read every image that we are faced with automatically with the view of perspective, which is a vanishing point, and that things recede into the distance, right? But it's all
made up.
It's all a trick. Yeah. It's all sleight of hand. It's all smoke and mirrors, you know, and they're conventions. So the resin was really about talking about just playing with that sense of space. It at once imparted like this really beautiful you know, almost infinite depth, but it also made you kind of almost painfully aware of surface, like a mirror does, you know, because you became aware of the activity of the surface of the room that you were standing in reflected in the resin and yourself looking back at yourself.
Bugger to photograph, Charles.
Oh, don't even get me started. Photograph was one thing, and then just moving the things around. Anyway, we won't go there.
But did you, you weren't, it said layers of resin. You weren't resining them, painting them.
No. I've been painting a very traditional kind of oil painting, you know, or very traditional oil paint technique. And then I would usually get it in two, maybe three layers of the resin just to get it completely almost,
And that's a bloody nightmare.
It is. It's not.
Do you have, did you have a
you have
resin
to mix those
room?
Two things together.
Yeah, and then you need a really controlled environment. Yes.
No dogs around.
No, that's what Orlando does. A friend of mine from the UK that we spoke to, she has a resin room.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I used to have in here. Big kind of. Anyway, I don't miss that.
No,
it's hot and it's stressful and it's heavy and it's. Oh, look.
But it achieved what you were
correct. After. Correct. And never say never. I mean, it's not like I don't paint with oil paints anymore. I just, that's not what I'm doing at the moment. And, and I always reserve the right to do whatever damn well please.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, gets me to where the, you know, the. The temporary destination, the next stop along, you know, the journey that I want to kind of get
definitely.
To.
Where do you get your imagery from?
All over, anywhere. There's no rules. I just, I mean, some of it's personal imagery, some of it, a lot of it's off the internet, some of it's out of old newspapers, old books, old anywhere.
Doesn't matter.
And do you change it? Or you slave to it?
Again, anything goes.
Yeah.
If I need to change it, I do. If I don't, I don't.
And how do you come up with your compositions? Do you see them? Or before, or do you draw?
I mean, I think that's just those kind of that is a. I don't know. That's probably the trickiest question of all.
Intuitive.
I don't. I certainly don't labour. Or I mean, some things just feel right. I mean, maybe again back to music. You know, there's certain relationships which perhaps you experience more readily in music. We're so, you know, you listen to music, whether you're a musician or not, and you can tell a discordant note, or you can tell when something's out of place, right?
When we listen to the kids' shows.
Oh, yes.
And you're like,
that's it. Yeah. And I think it's the same visually, I think, and the more you do it, the more you, you know, attune your senses, the more, and sometimes you want to play with that discordant kind of ingredient, and that
but,
can.
But when you're putting a, do you work to bodies of work? Or do you work from one work to another? Or how do you go? Like, do you have deadlines and...
Yeah, I like a deadline. I don't mind a deadline. I think they're a neat way of kind of... Otherwise, you can spiral off into, you know...
Mm.
But that's fine. I tend to, I guess, kind of spend some time thinking of, you know, like an idea, but... It's actually always a continuation of, you know, the one idea. So I don't know. I think I just kind of I start making and it, you know, because there's for every one painting that makes it to the gallery wall, there's you know, there's 10 or 30 or there's many that never get made, you know, because there is a time component to my practice. It is quite laborious and quite kind of time consuming. That's why it's been really nice to have this kind of musical kind of revelation and it's allowed me to free my practice in certain ways. And
do you lock in? Do you find yourself, you get a bit sort of obsessive, you're locked in?
I wouldn't
in
call
and
myself obsessive. It's odd, actually. I don't consider what I do particularly obsessive. I'm actually quite pragmatic.
I can imagine that.
I am. Oh, yeah. I look.
Well, just because you paint like that doesn't mean you're obsessive, right?
No, I don't know. You know. I can see you locking in and being.
There's a point where I'm happy to draw the line, and I'm happy to draw the line in the name of, I'll sort that out next time.
Okay.
You know, because it's all learning and it's all, well, you know, there's very rarely a painting that ticks every box. Yeah. You know, there's always, you know, stuff I could adjust. I mean, you get to, let's say you get to a 90-95 percentile and you just got to, I mean, like, I'm never, you know, 100%, you know, only in your own mind, this is, by the way, it's not,
yeah,
right. It's death, right? I mean, like, when
I said, the most successful day of your life will be when you die, right?
Oh, that's right. That's it. Job done.
Yeah, job done.
Yeah.
So the other thing I want to ask is that, I know everyone's individual and everyone has their own path in their art practice, but do you think you need to acquire technical skills before you break them?
So that, so the short answer to that is emphatically yes. And it might not be a popular kind of thing to say, but I've always, so, you know, that age old thing, you know, some, let's say a lay person, it's an awful term. Someone who doesn't have an art practice looks at Picasso and says, my kid could do that. You know, it's like the age of, all right, that's cool, whatever. But the point they miss is that Picasso could virtually, not quite, but he was a fairly good Velázquez kind of imitator by the time he was about 17, 18. So he had well and truly earned his chops. And
absolutely.
You have, in my mind, you have to be able to, you have to be able to construct before you can deconstruct.
Mm.
So that's, you know, I mean, jazz is a fantastic, you know, example, because I think anyone who has any, whether you like jazz or not, but anyone who has a kind of musical, any kind of musical appreciation will probably, or if you bother to kind of, you know, familiarize yourself in any way, shape or form with, you know, how freaking, you know, what a minefield music is for someone like me. I mean, there's some people who find it very natural and I hate them dearly. No. But, you know, it's a form that, you know, there's really abstract elements, you know, to the art form, and they're arguably the most provocative and endearing and ecstatic and engaging, and it's fucking terrifyingly free form. But those guys are, and girls are, terrifyingly good musicians. They know their craft back to front.
Mm.
And for me, look, that I tend to agree. You know, visually, I think it's the same.
Mm.
Do you think that's like a Western tradition thing? Because people like, you know, we often talk about, I do like Sally Gabori. I can't say her Aboriginal name. Had no instruction whatsoever and came out the gates at 80.
That's a really, really good point to make. Almost certainly that is a Western tradition. Yeah. I can only really speak, you know, confidently from the tradition that I grew up in and that I inhabit. But you're absolutely right. And I think that is why Indigenous art, you know, Indigenous painting is so, so kind of deeply appreciated and genuinely, you know, kind
revered.
Of heralded and revered internationally, because it's almost like, you know, a kind of like, you know, almost like trying to duck into, you know, our ancient minds. You know, it's being kind of free from, you know, that bloody, you know, constrictive, westernized, all the stuff that I embrace and are the strengths of my work are also massive hindrances to, you know, other aspects of what I'm interested in. And it's probably about the closest we have, you know, to, you know, in a contemporary world, to tapping into that really primordial kind of human experience.
Yeah, it is quite amazing. I mean, I think, you know, people like her were one of a kind, you know, to come out like that with just that kind of innate knowledge to paint like that with an acrylic paints and a paintbrush is quite incredible. But, yeah, it's, you know, just you see a lot of work and you're like, I don't know whether the steps have been missed.
Yeah.
You know, there just seems to be a massive jump. And it would be great to have more courses out there that are – purely technical.
Yes. Yeah.
Purely can you hold a brush? How do you get paint on your brush? Like all these things, I know you can YouTube it, but, you know, those, we seem that they're not that easily available.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I think the crux of it, though, ultimately, is that there is just no substitute for doing. You know, it's just like me learning my scales on the guitar, you know. I can read it intellectually and I can go to as many classes and schools and stuff, but there's no fucking substitute for just...
hours.
Bonkers hours doing this same thing over and over and over.
Yeah.
And I think that is actually where, you know, our idea of talent actually... Look, I have a problem with the term talent. I think it's like a natural disposition. I think it's the willingness to just mindlessly do something. You're so kind of enthralled and seduced by this thing, whatever it is, whether it's dancing or writing or, you know, or geology or you know,
eating.
they require immense amounts of dedication and hours weeks and months and years of, you know. Yeah. There's no shortcuts, and that's the beautiful thing.
And it's an exciting way to live.
Yeah.
Right? It's like being alive. Yeah. It's otherwise you're not really being in the world. You know, all this exploration is really exciting to be around, to be in.
Yeah.
Well, Giles, you are definitely an exciting in the world artist. that was a great ending. Now, what is on next for you, Giles?
Well, I am...
What's coming up?
So... On the spot now. No, look, I've got some really great conversations with galleries overseas at the moment. So next year I would... Because, you know, COVID, I think, has done a strange thing to, you know, lots of people. Psychologically, if not actually kind of physically. But I'm kind of reconnecting with... I've been showing with gallery in the States for the last few years. I'll possibly do something with them. Then there's, you know... some other galleries in London and in Asia.
Wow.
So yeah, and then you know, there's more. I show with Mars Gallery down in Melbourne, so that will probably be my next Australian exhibition.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
we will look out for it.
We will. We'd love to talk to them.
Yeah, it's very exciting to see what's going to happen next with you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking
to
us.
Thank you for having us, Giles.
We've had a ball. Thank you.
Please don't forget to rate and review and share this podcast. It helps my mom and her friend Fiona get more listeners. Thank you.